This is Craig Lubo, and thank you for joining us here on Radioactive Magazine. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. And now we will go to Spencer Graves.
Welcome to Radioactive Magazine for September 29th. I'm Spencer Graves. This evening we will discuss optimal public health with Professor Edward Ellerbeck, Chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine and Public Health at the University of Kansas Medical Center, and Dr. Doug Samuelson, President and Chief Scientist at Infologics Incorporated, an R&D and consulting firm in Annandale, Virginia. Samuelson is also first Vice Chair of the Advisory Board of the Health Service Agency of Northern Virginia, and author of multiple articles since at least 2008 on preparing for biological crises like the current one. How are we doing, Craig? We're doing okay? Good. So, Professor Ellerbeck, why don't you explain a bit more than my excessively brief bio and tell our audience what you think are the most important things about the current pandemic that may not have received adequate attention in the mainstream media so far.
Great, Dr. Graves, thanks so much for having me join you this evening. Really delighted to be here with you virtually. So this pandemic has gotten an incredible amount of media coverage, but there still are some big gaps in what we've been talking about. I think one of the big gaps that I've seen is that while we've, basically that we haven't covered a lot about the testing, the results of the testing process and the contact tracing. There's lots of differences between just getting tested and then following up with people after they've gotten tested, and then identifying who their contacts are and getting those individuals in isolation so we can actually mitigate the pandemic. And a lot of that information really hasn't hit the mainstream about how well we're doing in that process. I think I actually forgot to introduce myself though. So I'm Ed Ellerbeck. I'm a general internist at the University of Kansas Health Center. Still see adult patients, and also work in the Cancer Center on cancer prevention and control activities, and also in primary care preventive services. We also do a lot of teaching related to public health education here at the medical center.
Wonderful. Dr. Samuelson?
Hi, I'm Doug Samuelson. How's my sound, by the way? We didn't do a sound check.
Wonderful. I think it's wonderful. How's the sound? It's fine.
Thank you. I'm Doug Samuelson. I have a doctorate in operations research, which means that I'm not a medical doctor, but I am a certified high-powered long-term experience number cruncher. And one of the things I've been doing analysis on for many, many years, as my bio indicates, is emergency preparedness, emergency response, some of the things we could do better to be more effective and more responsive to crises. It's kind of like we Jews just celebrated Yom Kippur. And there are all kinds of credentials a person can get to be a cantor, the singing leader of a Jewish service. But the fact of the matter is, if a person wants to get hired as a cantor, what's going to happen is they'll look through all the credentials, they'll call them in for an interview. Okay, let's hear you sing Kol Nidre. If you can't sing it, you're not hired. If you can sing it, you don't need the credentials. So I'm a guy who can sing it but doesn't have the credentials as far as public health is concerned. I've been studying this for a long time. I've been tracking a lot of stuff, and I think I can convince you that I know what I'm talking about. The first thing I'm going to tell you is, in case you haven't noticed, the information we have on which to base any kinds of public policy decisions, any kinds of assessment of how we're doing, any kinds of guidance about what we ought to be doing, that information is terrible. We simply have no clue. And I'll give you one really prominent example. In the middle of August, there was an 8-day motorcycle riding conclave in Sturgis, estimated 450,000 people got together there and rode motorcycles out on the open road and had a grand old time. And every night they were together in bars and restaurants. One night they had a big old concert where they were crammed shoulder to shoulder, no distancing, no masks. So, question, how many people got sick? How many people got COVID-19 because of that event? Now, if you go out and scan the net, you will find plenty of answers. You will find some people who say, well, we can confirm 700 cases of people who seem to have been infected as a result of going to Sturgis. There is also an article that's got wide circulation from four university professors out on the West Coast. We're estimating 267,000 infected. Now, do you need a half dozen graduate courses in statistics to know that a number that's somewhere between 700 and 267,000 is not really a very good number and not one that you can rely on to conclude much about anything? That's where we are.
Wow, that's a major indictment to the current process. So what do we need to do to fix the gaps that you've just described, Professor?
Long term, we might want to pull a few people over from the sports page and the financial pages to the general news section to talk about health, because those are the people who can count with past 10 with their shoes on. Sports page and finance page is where the people with any number ability go.
Well, but isn't there something more than just the coverage in the news? I mean, is there not substance that they're not reporting on, or the substance is not being collected?
I don't know how much of a problem we have with too little being reported. I think we have a huge problem with too much misinformation being reported, and in some cases deliberate disinformation, that makes it very hard for not only the average citizen, but actually somebody like me who's trying to help a public health board figure out how much trouble we're in. What numbers can I rely on? What can I actually say about whether certain trends are going up or down, whether certain kinds of events are really harmful or not? I will probably cycle back at some point here to the Scowcroft Institute report, which was cited in the background materials for this. Scowcroft Institute for Public Policy at Texas A&M University did a major comprehensive report on public health preparedness in November of 2019.
I think it was May of 2019.
I think you're right. The Nuclear Threat Initiative thing was November. Scowcroft was May of 19, you're right. And what they said was a very heavy emphasis on information shortfalls of cooperation, breakdown of trust among professionals in different places, especially different countries, about what can we believe from what these other folks are saying. That has been a huge contributor, and would be a huge contributor to a problem if we had a big event. And I think we're seeing that play out.
Dr. Ellerbeck, would you care to comment?
I actually agree that we have some serious problems with information, developing reliable information, and in the gap of that reliable information, we get lots of rumors and innuendo and misinformation. So we clearly need reliable sources that we can trust.
Do you think the information is not being collected, or it's being collected but it's not being released?
I think in the example of Sturgis, I think capturing that information is actually can be difficult. But an underlying problem is the lack of interactive information systems. So each of our pieces of data lives in its own repository. So every state collects their own data. It's processed within each separate county. And that information isn't necessarily integrated with our electronic health records. We don't really have a functioning integrated health system and integrated with our public health system.
By the way, for our listeners, the the May report that Dr. Samuelson mentioned, a link to that is provided on the description of this episode of Radioactive Magazine at kkfi.org. And Dr. Samuelson, if there's another thing that I've missed, I can add that later.
Well, the annoying thing about the Scowcroft Institute report is that you can only read it online. At last I checked, there was no way you could download it or get it in print, anything other than just reading it online. It's like 60 pages long. So this is a bit of an endeavor. I summarized some of the major points in an article for the Global Peace Services newsletter, which I think we also cited.
Yeah.
That was June of 2020. And I think a lot of, certainly in like 4 pages, 5 pages I wrote, I couldn't do justice to a 60-page report, plus some additional information, but at least I could make the main point that the breakdown of cooperation, the breakdown of collaborative preventive measures, and the breakdown of good, reliable public information was trouble waiting for a place to happen, and I think we found the place.
And by the way, for our listeners, if you go to Radioactive Magazine on kkfi.org, the description of this episode does contain a link to Dr. Samuelson's June 2020 article that he just mentioned. So what do we need to do? What do you suggest we do to fix the problem?
Well, all of us, we citizens, have to be, I think, more insistent on good information. I think we have to learn how to, there's a lot we have to learn about how to recognize what we see on the internet, what we see in even fairly established news media needs to be questioned. Were there two sources? Were they good sources? Is somebody speculating because he's filling airtime or space because he doesn't know? You know, after a while, if you compare alternative sources for a while and you think about it a bit, you track reliability over time, you kind of get a feel and you can push back at whatever media you're interacting with. Come on, tell me more. Tell me why I should believe that. There's only so much you can do. I think at some point, and this is not the time, the time frame to do this is too long, but this is not the time. We treated, in particular, news media airtime as a public good. You had to have a license to be in there. There were requirements you had to meet. There were all kinds of fairness and reliability tests applied to what you did and called news. That's a public good. And we argue from time to time about the virtues of free markets, and we all love free markets, and everybody wants freer markets, but free markets don't work except within a regulatory structure that assures fairness and prevents a thugocracy.
Right.
We have a completely free market, and I'm making a lot of money, and you decide you don't like that, you can hire thugs to take my money. And that means that I have to hire thugs to keep you from doing that. And then we have to worry about whether I hire enough thugs that I can go take your money. Only within a regulatory framework do the benefits of the free market really accrue. And what you sometimes don't realize is which things are public goods. Public health is a public good. A well-functioning integrated health system with reliable, transmissible medical records is a public good. And a public information structure that keeps people informed and reliably informed about what's going on and what they might need to do is a public good. You wouldn't think about operating a major city down on the Gulf without having a structure somebody can activate. Here are the alerts that are going out to the radio stations and the TV, and they're going to broadcast them exactly the way that we send them, because people have to know what's coming and which way they need to flee. That's a public good. We do it for hurricanes. We don't do it for epidemics. We should.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Well, Dr. Samuelson, don't you think that reflects some of our chronic underinvestment in public health? And then you also talked about the need for the media to be vigilant and function as a public good, to the extent that we actually are underinvesting now in our local media that can actually do the investigative reporting that can help us delineate the truth. That becomes another threat to maintaining our public health.
Now, that may be getting very close to the kind of call for action we were told not to engage in this program, since it's a call for action to support KKFI, but yes.
Right. No, I think... Right. And by the way, that brings in, I'm actually doing a program this Saturday on the Local Journalism Sustainability Act and information on how to sign up for that. It's going to be rebroadcast a week from this Thursday. And that's information on how to sign up for that is on the Thursday night, kkfi.org. Go to Thursday night special, and for that episode tells you more about that. But you're saying you think the gap is more in the media than in the what the politicians, that we ought to be pressing more on the media than on the politicians to make sure that we get the proper information?
I think it was more the question you asked of what's being neglected, where we're not holding the media enough to account. The politicians are primarily responsible for the failures to respond effectively, for dismantling preventive and detecting measures that were originally put in place by the George W. Bush administration and expanded under Obama.
Right.
There are a lot of things we could be doing to monitor better, to alert better, to cooperate better. And those are all political. That's not media, that's political. We could be doing a much better job of contact tracing. We get test results, but we don't tie the test results back to events or push them forward to, now who else did these people come in contact with? With Sturgis, for example, those two professors in California were relying on a study by one of the cell phone companies. They could tell which cell phones had been in Sturgis during that week and where they then went. This is how we have a number of how many people are capable of transmitting if they were infected. In other countries, the cell phone data would be something the government could grab hold of and follow up contacting all of those people. Where were you? Were you exposed? We want to test you now. Who else have you exposed since you got back? We would run into fantastic constitutionality objections from our populace for doing that. But, you know, there are times when the public good has to override individual freedom. Absolutely blasphemous thought in the United States of America, but we're facing the consequences of not recognizing that there are times when the public good overrides.
Agreed. So talk to us about the history of other health public health crises, from the Black Death of the 14th century to the AIDS crisis of the 1980s. We had a brief interaction in preparing for this discussion.
So in the show notes that you have, Dr. Samuelson, go ahead.
You want to take that one?
Well, I can just start that. I do more recent history. So in thinking about some of the response to this epidemic, I went back to reread And the Band Played On. I think you have it in your show notes. And it drew a lot of corollaries to the existing crises. A lot of the inaction by certain government entities, the slow response, the misinformation, disbelief. It took them 3 years to close the bathhouses It took years to actually get the administration to respond and put in financial resources to responding to AIDS. I do have to admit the difference here is that we actually have put a lot more federal investment in the response than we actually did during the AIDS crisis. But certainly a lot of the miscommunication persisted that we saw then, and the mistrust we see again.
Yeah, true. And I would add in the story about "And the Band Played On," you're talking about how long it took to close the bathhouses where they closed them. There were some communities where there was a lot more pushback than others. There's another little feature of all this that I think is, as a number cruncher, I want to make this point. Most of the models people used to figure out what was going on and where do you need to look and what do you need to trace were these differential equation models, what are called SIR models, susceptible, infected, recovered, or removed, where that model structure is driven by the activity of the most active spreader. With "And the Band Played On," there's this just gripping story of how this young CDC guy gets some of the gay leaders in San Francisco together and says, "I've got a model that seems to fit, but it can't be right. There's got to be something wrong with this. According to this model, the most active spreader would have to be having 1,000 different sex partners per year for a couple of years. And that's not physically possible. What am I doing wrong?" And after a moment of awkward silence, one of the gay leaders said, "Your model is correct. Let us explain to you what a gay bathhouse is and what happens there." So there was a model that did fit, that could explain what was going on with HIV. The models we have for COVID do not fit and do not work. And the reason is that the spread mechanism is different. It's not driven by the most active spreader. It's driven by the formation of groups in which they're spread. And those differential equation models don't capture that. I've been working on one that does. And let me tell you, it's quite a challenge. But that's been part of the problem. If you're looking for the super spreader individual, you're missing the mechanism of spread here. It's really, don't look for the person who's running around, you know, hugging everybody in town. Look for the choir rehearsal.
Okay, so we're discussing optimal public health with Professor Edward Ellerbach, Chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine and Public Health at the University of Kansas Medical Center, and Dr. Doug Samuelson, President of Infologix, Incorporated in Annandale, Virginia, and author of multiple articles since at least 2008 on preparing for biological crises. Doug, you want to continue with what you were just saying, or does Professor Ellerbach care to respond to that?
I'll defer to him. I've been, I think, taking more than my share of time here.
No, I actually agree with you. I think that the initial models talking about random distribution of infected and susceptible individuals are preposterous. And certainly people do clump. They don't act like random dots moving around. If you actually look at the YouTube video that explains the underlying assumptions behind those models, they just don't fit. I mean, they do give you some sense of how you might be able to mitigate or what worst case scenarios might be, but it's pretty clear that the congregation or aggregation of susceptible individuals with infected people drives epidemics, and that relates to congregating people in large groups, just like you suggested. And we just don't have good mathematical models to simulate that. I'm glad somebody's working on it, though.
It's not even just large groups. It's specific structures of large groups. You get a whole bunch of people out at a concert on the beach and they distance, there's not much of a problem if they distance. You get a bunch of people in a closed room where there's much less circulation of outside air, and let's say they sing. Singing turns out to be a wonderful way to transmit it because it travels in small droplets from deep in the lungs. So a good singing technique just spreads those kinds of droplets about 5 feet away.
Yeah, our colleagues here at the medical center did a nice demo in that in the deep freezer where they actually took off their masks and sang and you could actually see it. So as the weather gets colder, I think people are going to understand this transmission dynamics a little bit better. Just follow your breath when you sing or shout.
So I think we have, I've been told we have 1 minute left. So it's time for concluding remarks by the two of you.
Well, I think the basic control mechanisms are fairly well understood and they've been covered. Unfortunately, they've been overly politicized and have impeded our response to this. I still am cautiously optimistic that we can make progress. But when we move into the next epidemic, I hope we have just better coordination of our effort and less undermining of scientific messages from our mainstream media and our scientific community.
Dr. Samuelson?
Well, of the 75 things I'd like to say, the one I think I'd like to emphasize is when you have a plan, you go into crisis and you have a plan, even if it's not a very good plan, you have a plan and you act by it. And then you can tell, everybody can tell what the plan was. Are you following it? Is it working? When you have 12 plans in competition and nobody knows how it's working, that generally does not work out well. That, I think, is kind of where we are now. I think that as soon as somebody says, we're going to let the public health experts tell us what to do now, tell us what the balance is between bolstering the economy and trying to contain the virus, we just get on everybody on one page of the music. It doesn't even have to be the right page, just so it's one page. You probably get better success.
Yep, great. So I want to thank our experts, Professor Edward Ellerbach, Chair of Department of Public Preventive Medicine and Public Health at the University of Kansas Medical Center, and Dr. Doug Samuelson, President of Infologic, Inc. in Annenberg, Virginia, and author of multiple articles over the past dozen or so years on preparing for biological crises. A few references they suggested are mentioned in the description of this episode of Radioactive Magazine on KKFI.org. And if I can steal another few seconds, I'd like to mention two other public affairs shows that I'm personally producing this Saturday, October 3rd at noon Central Time. I'm organizing a virtual Zoom forum on the local Journalism Sustainability Act concerns and opportunities. This forum will be broadcasted on KKFI the following Thursday night special, October 8th, 7 to 8 p.m. And you can get information on that from the episode description of that Thursday night special. Also earlier that Thursday at October 8th at noon, the National syndicated show Sprouts will carry a half-hour condensation of the discussion of electoral integrity in the United States carried on KKFI on August 13th. I'm Spencer Graves. Thanks to Craig Lubo, our engineer, this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you for doing that for us. And coming up next, we have a couple of spots and then Counterspin, followed by Take the Piano.
Okay. Is there anything else you, the two of you, would like to say to add to the remarks that I'll post on Wikiversity?
I thought that you got a lot covered, Doug. That was very nice. I like the way you put the frame the stories and stick with the big pictures. I have a tendency to get down to the specifics far too soon.
Well, that's kind of what I'm trained to do. As an operations research analyst, I can get into the details too, but you really want to leave the decision maker with an understanding that they believe is comprehensive enough to act on. And I've had a lot of practice trying to do that. That said, you know, we could probably put together another half hour next week.
Well, any one of those themes we could have riffed on for, I think, a half hour quite easily. So, thanks, Spencer, for bringing us together. I don't have anything else.
I don't think we even got into the question of how do we know whether we have good test kits? And if not, why not? And what do we do about it? And that's been one of the issues.
Well, that and the uncertainty, the lack of communications about when to get tested, what to do with asymptomatic individuals, You know, the idea that it took us, what, 2 months before we actually would admit that masks actually worked. Talk about being unprepared or caught with for an epidemic with your pants down. It's kind of hard to believe we didn't have that in our back pocket.
I don't think we knew. I remember back early in the conversations, Dr. Fauci saying that hand washing was much more effective and much more important than mask wearing. Mask wearing seemed to be something that was very good if you're infected to keep from spreading it, but not all that good if you're not infected to keep from getting it.
But it was that, it's a precisely that issue that is of fundamental importance. If we have universal masking, then you keep everybody from creating that aerosol. And, you know, that really did not create rocket science research to actually do. It's very frustrating.
I was in Seoul in 2015 when the MERS epidemic hit there. So everybody was running around town wearing masks. And I was hearing then from people who I thought were pretty knowledgeable, this is a nice thing to do to keep people conscious of the fact that there's a virus out there and they need to do something. But it's going to have zero effect. It is not helping at all. And in fact, if you go back and look carefully at the fatalities from MERS in Seoul in 2015, there are 184 of them. One of them was the doctor who went to Egypt to learn about infectious diseases at a conference and brought it back with him. One was an ambulance driver, and 182 got it in the emergency room. Somebody'd get sick, the family would go in and sit with them. This was transmitted mostly by mouth to hand to mouth contact, not by aerosol. So those were the people who got it. And the way that they stopped the epidemic very, very quietly, they didn't make any noise about this, but the way they stopped the epidemic was to close the two biggest emergency rooms.
Now, the other thing actually that I would have gotten into, again, if we got into technical details, is our whole contact tracing system was based on tuberculosis and sexually transmitted diseases. And frankly, in this communication age where we're supposed to have such fantastic communications, we're worse than ever before. I was kind of impressed with the MMWR. We're over 6 months into this epidemic, and they finally reported some of their data on the success of their contact tracing. they're only able to get about half of the people, identify any contacts. And of those, we actually contact less than half of them, and the median time to contact them is 6 days. So that's a completely broken system. Yeah. And, you know, you actually know it as well as I do. You don't answer your phone anymore when it's an unknown number. We have such little trust there. And, you know, I just find it amazing that in this information age, we can't actually contact people when we need to. And frankly, it happens in the medical system too. When I try to call one of my patients, they think I'm from KU trying to give them a bill, call them about their bills. And so they don't want to talk to me about their test results. So our ability to contact people is really flawed. And in the face of an epidemic, that's seriously problematic. Now, everybody will answer their texts.
Yeah.
But, you know, all we have to be able to do, if we wanted to make contact tracing work right, we would just say, hey, we just need the text numbers of them. We're going to text them a link that they may have been exposed, and here it is. It could still all be kept confidential, but whatever.
Yes.
Now, I'm getting 50 texts a day from somebody trying to raise money for Donald Trump. I have no idea how they got my cell phone number. Nobody's preventing that, but I could not get a text from somebody who had identified a contact to COVID for me because for some reason it might create a charge on my account or something. I don't know what it is. But anyway, those are the types of things I think we need to actually do differently to prepare for the next epidemic. But we could have riffed on the communication. If we were going to do another half hour, I'd want to riff on the communications debacle.
I would too. And I would probably get in a little more deeply to the challenges to clinical practice of an organism that spreads differently from what we're used to, and just figuring out what is dangerous behavior. I don't know, but I've been told, and I am not volunteering to be in the test group for this experiment, that standing 5 feet away from somebody and singing for a few minutes is more likely to transmit it than a French kiss.
Yeah, I don't know. I probably wouldn't want to do those tests. But again,
I'm not volunteering to be in the test group, but that's what I understand from the science of it. And yes, it's counterintuitive.
Yeah. But you know, it's the trick is we just haven't invested in that type of research. And preparing for a pandemic, that's the type of fundamental research we need to have in place about those types of transmissions. And, you know, it's not that hard to create laboratory models of that and test devices.
Laboratory models and test devices, yes. Tests on human subjects, not so easy. Human Subjects Committee might have a few things to say about deliberate exposure.
We actually did it with influenza. We can't do it with coronavirus. I think the complications are a little bit too severe.
Right. Yeah.